Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation. With a new partnership, you can now find C-section and other maternity care ratings for your local hospital on Yelp.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we'll find out why the Volkswagen diesel emissions scandal could give local electric car users a boost. We'll also talk with the new president of Fresno Pacific University, Dr. Joseph Jones. We'll learn how he hopes his unique background in criminology and in leading a university in Pakistan can help him lead the Valley's largest private university. And we'll find out what leaders in Yosemite hope to do to deal with the national park's trash problem. Right now, though, we begin with a new report in our series about the Valley's doctor shortage. As the San Joaquin Valley struggles with the shortage of primary care physicians, one group in particular is stepping in to fill the gaps: doctors born or trained in foreign countries. And while the planned repeal of the DACA program is President Trump's most recent immigration policy change, he's hinted at others that could influence the flow of foreign physicians into the Valley. As the fourth installment in our series Struggling for Care, FM 89's Carrie Klein explores the Valley's complicated relationship with international doctors.
So I heard you're here for shoulder pain this time.
Yes.
You want to have a seat over here?
Dr. Olga Mayave is a third-year family medicine resident in Bakersfield. She spends most of her time in a Clinica Sierra Vista clinic on the outskirts of the city.
How would you describe the pain? Is it burning sensation? Is it like a sharp pain? Is it just...
Mayave was born in northern Mexico. From a young age, she aspired to be a doctor like her mother, but she wanted to practice in the U.S. After a high school exchange program in New York, Mayave attended medical school in Guadalajara and was already a practicing physician when she decided to return to the U.S. She had to get recertified here and eventually enrolled in the Rio Bravo Family Medicine Residency Program. She became a U.S. citizen this past spring. After she graduates next year, she plans to stay in Bakersfield.
You know, it's not the prettiest, but I felt comfortable. It's just, it reminded me of home in a way. The weather, the people, and I like it.
Throughout California, roughly 27% of all doctors are international medical graduates, or IMGs, like Mayave. Here in the Valley, that number is nearly 50%. Many are incentivized to practice in underserved communities like ours, but they like it here and they stay, filling a critical need in areas overburdened with disease and short on physicians. Dr. Sanjay Srivatsa is a cardiologist and director of the Heart, Artery, and Vein Center in Fresno. He got his medical degree in the UK.
Whether you look at the residency fellowship system, the faculty at the university, whether you look at the Veterans Administration Hospital, Kaiser Permanente, private practice, you will find an enormous contribution by foreign medical graduates.
Our reliance on these IMGs also makes us vulnerable to changes in immigration policy, which many worry could leave the Valley hurting for doctors more than it already is.
I would venture to say that if you removed all foreign medical graduates or foreign trained graduates from the system here in Fresno, it would collapse.
You don't have to go far to find a physician from one of the 87 countries represented in the southern San Joaquin Valley. Dr. Jorge Martinez is from Colombia and is a hospitalist with Community Regional Medical Center in downtown Fresno.
We have people from Bulgaria, we have people from Eastern Europe, we have people from Asia, Cambodia, Vietnam, Nigeria, and it's like the mini United Nations. We are like 26 countries.
The biggest suppliers are India, Caribbean nations, and the Philippines. IMGs are more likely to practice in primary care, where the Valley has 35% fewer physicians than the government recommends. Many of our Spanish-speaking IMGs are graduates of a UCLA program that helps them pass exams and land residencies in exchange for working for a few years in medically underserved areas. The U.S. government also makes these areas attractive. When IMGs come to the U.S., no matter how much experience they have, they're required to complete a residency before they can practice. To do this, most get a J-1 or foreign exchange visa, When it expires, they're required to return home, unless they spend 3 years working in an underserved area. After the J-1, foreign doctors commonly move on to the H-1B visa. That program brings in specialty workers ostensibly for jobs that Americans can't fill. After a certain number of years on the H-1B, doctors can then apply for permanent residency and a path to citizenship. But this past spring, President Trump hinted at changes to this pathway. He signed an executive order in April calling for an independent review of the H-1B program.
Right now, widespread abuse in our immigration system is allowing American workers of all backgrounds to be replaced by workers brought in from other countries to fill the same job for sometimes less pay.
Deepak Ahluwalia is an immigration lawyer in Fresno. He says, sure, the H-1B program could use some improvements, but too many doctors is not the problem.
If we specifically talk about doctors, that policy won't work because, as we've discussed, they're having a problem hiring doctors here or finding doctors here.
Before the executive order, the administration had already made one change. It revoked expedited processing of H-1B applications. Ahluwalia doesn't know what happened locally. But elsewhere, some IMGs were forced out of the U.S. because they couldn't get visas quickly enough to hold on to job offers.
So it didn't work out too well this time. They reinstated it after obviously realizing the huge blunder. And one can only hope that any other policies they think of in the future, they're actually going to consult with doctors. They're going to consult with areas that are designated by the government to be underserved.
A few weeks ago, the Wall Street Journal reported the Trump administration was also considering restricting the J-1 visa program, but no specifics have emerged. Even if immigration policies remain unchanged, many health leaders worry recent anti-immigrant rhetoric could be enough to scare away aspiring international doctors. Michael Peterson, Associate Dean of UCSF Fresno, is concerned. Right now, 31% of his graduate residents and fellows are IMGs.
They're roughly a third of our trainees. And so to lose that number would be a significant deficit in terms of the physicians we'd be putting out into the communities.
There's no indication yet that doctors elsewhere are thinking twice about emigrating to the U.S. Applications for H-1B visas did drop this year, but it's too early to determine if it's a trend. Nevertheless, most health authorities I spoke to said waning interest from international doctors is a major concern.
Push my hand with your face. That doesn't hurt.
Back in Bakersfield, Olga Mayave points out if she were looking to undercut American jobs, this was not an easy way to do it. To practice here, doctors like her have to repeat years of training and exams they already completed in their home countries.
And I knew it was extremely competitive and hard, but I really wanted it.
Now, the U.S. government will have to decide how much it wants international doctors. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
This report is the latest in our series, Struggling for Care, a reporting project about the Valley's doctor shortage. You can find more of the stories online at kvpr.org. The series is part of the California Health Journalism Fellowship, presented by the USC Annenberg School of Communication. A major scandal rocked the U.S. auto industry 2 years ago when it was discovered the car company Volkswagen had been systematically cheating on emissions tests, like those required by the state of California. The company has since reached a massive settlement worth more than $1 billion. A significant chunk of that could be headed to the Central Valley. Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess reports regulators and activists see this money as the bridge from a gas-powered present to an electric vehicle future.
Jessie Fierro is a typical busy mother of two young children with a typically packed family car.
Kind of a mom-mobile, so I managed to keep the front pretty clean. But you'll see in the back, I got both my car seats ready to go.
She drives a Chevy Bolt. That's an all-electric vehicle with a range of about 230 miles, which for electric cars is really good. Still, Fiera says she's always aware of where the next charging station is and sometimes plans her trip around them.
And when I've taken my longer trips out of town, of course, I'm trying to find destinations close to chargers just so the kids aren't getting too fussy while I'm charging my car. But for the most part, when I'm putzing about town, I know where a handful of chargers are. There are apps, too, for your phone. So you can go on the phone and say, okay, I'm going to be here. Where are the chargers nearby?
Fiera says she has no regrets about going electric and rarely charges her car at home, preferring to find chargers in the wild. And she might soon find that easier and easier, because something happened on the way to the charging station.
A big development in one of the biggest scandals in the history of the auto industry. Volkswagen has reached a broad settlement to compensate owners of diesel cars that came rigged with technology to cheat emissions tests.
That's a clip from NBC Nightly News, when news of a massive settlement over the VW emissions scandal broke. As part of that settlement, $800 million will go toward electric vehicle infrastructure and access in California. Of that, $280 million is supposed to be dedicated to low-income and high-pollution areas, areas like the Central Valley. Joel Espino with the environmental advocacy group The Greenlining Institute says the focus is on areas like Fresno, Bakersfield, and the rest of the valley because they have suffered the most due to VW's deceit.
Those emissions, those extra emissions that were put into the air, didn't affect everyone equally. A lot of the communities who live near busy roads and freeways, low-income communities of color, were harmed the most as a result.
So now a plan is in motion to build up the support network needed to make electric cars viable in low-income areas and across the broad rural plains of the valley. Dean Flores is with the California Air Resources Control Board, which helped craft the settlement.
I mean, it's kind of like, you know, asking someone to buy an iPhone, having it fully charged and then leaving, you know, the store and then having to be told you can only charge it at the local post office, which might be 30 or 40 miles away.
He says previously the Central Valley was not appealing for companies to set up charging stations on their own. He says this led to a chicken and egg scenario where there aren't enough places to charge, so people are turned off by an EV, but there aren't enough EVs for companies to install charging stations.
Unless we have more density in terms of infrastructure, getting the Central Valley, which is in dire need of mobile source reduction pollution, to move the EVs is almost an impossibility.
Flores sees this settlement as just the boost electric vehicles need. And it's coming at a time when electric vehicles seem to be finding their niche. This year, EVs are expected to represent 3% of new car sales statewide. That would be an all-time high. At this point, it's unclear where the stations will actually go. However, Flores says they have an agreement with Volkswagen to check in every month and make sure the chargers are being spread out to the areas that most need them, not just the areas where they'll be most used. Some possibilities include workplaces, grocery stores, public parks, and big box retailers with their massive parking lots. Frequent and convenient charging stations is perhaps the most critical part of the plan, according to Jamie Holt with the San Joaquin Valley Air Pollution Control District.
We need charging stations to be as prevalent throughout the valley as gas stations are now.
She says they are trying to change hearts and minds about the reliability of access to power for electric vehicles, especially for people who live in apartments or park on the street where charging at home is not possible.
We really want folks to feel like even though they can't charge at home, they still will have the ability to charge out in the world. You know, you can't put gas in your car at your home. Most people don't have a gas station at their house. So really, it's no different than that.
Holt says the more the cars saturate the market, the more likely it is people will become comfortable with the idea of driving an electric car. She also says they're working to break the perception that electric cars are only something that rich people on the coast use. To that end, she says there are a wealth of rebate and prebate programs, some that are income-based, to help low and moderate income families go electric. And that's especially true in the Valley, where people could stand to benefit the most. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Jeffrey Hess.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Fresno Pacific University has a new leader, Dr. Joseph Jones. The private nonprofit Christian University has been a fixture in Southeast Fresno for over 60 years and is increasingly gaining national recognition, including earlier this week when the university was ranked number 32 in the nation in Washington Monthly's Bang for Your Buck West
list of higher education institutions. Before accepting the new job earlier this year, Dr. Jones was the vice rector for Foreman Christian College in Lahore, Pakistan, which is the third oldest university in that country's history. He's an ordained minister and has a PhD in criminal justice, and he joins us now on Valley Edition. Dr. Jones, welcome.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
First of all, let's talk a little more about your background. You most recently were in Pakistan. Before that, though, I understand you have roots in Chicago and in Virginia. Tell us a little more about your path that brought you here to Fresno.
Well, I've served as a dean at Messiah College in Pennsylvania, then moved from there to North Park University. I was the provost there in Chicago. Then from North Park, that's when I went to Pakistan to be the vice rector at that university.
So what interested you in this job at Fresno Pacific? What caught your attention here or your eye in this community and this university specifically?
Well, I've always been involved with universities that were engaged in the city, that actually intentionally paired theory and praxis, but were faith-based institutions. And the faith element was the motivation factor for being engaged in communities and so forth. And so part of, as I began to hear about Fresno and the region and seeing what a university, impact a university could have, I saw that Fresno Pacific, I had the potential for having an incredible impact in this particular region. I went to Pakistan because that university had opportunity to have an impact on the country. I went to Chicago and went to a Messiah in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania area, all because we believe that those institutions could actually have an impact on the region. And so my sense of call and ministry, you might say, has been extending the influence of God's kingdom. And that's what these universities have done. So as we begin to look at Fresno Pacific, we saw that it had all of the framework for that. There was the commitment to that. We saw that there were a number of opportunities for us to actually make partnerships, university-community partnerships. And so those are the major things that interested me.
So in talking about some of those partnerships, what specifically would you like to accomplish in your tenure? We all have a limited window in which we can really make an impact in a particular job before we move on to something else. What would you like to have as your legacy? Now, you're at the start of your career here at Fresno Pacific, but when you walk away at some point, what do you want to say I accomplished here at this campus?
Well, one of the things I'd like it to be said, not so much about me, but about the university, is that we have had a significant impact in the region, you say, not only in terms of this particular community. One of the things that we've been sharing and almost kind of have built my personal motto that we've kind of extended to the community is that we should be a university that engages the cultures and serve the cities. And so that's what we're actually doing. And so our assessment of our strategic priorities, our assessment of what we're going to be doing here, we'll be going back and looking at how have we engaged the cultures and served the cities. We prepare our students for leadership and service. And so how can we do that intentionally? We can't just do that by our students just staying on our campus. That comes with service learning and engaging. How do you actually practice what you're actually learning at the institution? And how do we actually look at solving real-world problems? That means that you have to actually get out in the community, know what's going on all around you. And so the cities and the towns are all around us become our laboratories, become our classrooms also. So we really use those assets. We would like to see that this region, not just the city here, but this region begins to really see that we are an asset. I know not just our graduates, but as a institution, that we are a real asset, and that we complement other institutions in the area. And so we don't necessarily see ourselves as coming to compete with others, but actually to complement those and working together so that we actually are part of that link in the success of and growth of this community.
I know it's still early in your tenure. You just officially started in July. Are there specific areas that you want to see the university focus on? I mean, you already have things like the Center for Community Transformation. You already have the Ames Center, which is doing great and teaching math educators and the STEM challenges that the country and this region faces. Are there specific things that you would like to see the university take on in an area that has a lot of different challenges?
Well, I think that's one of the things that we're trying to do right now. I've met with the mayor in Bakersfield just last week. I'm meeting with the mayor of Fresno today. You know, say well, we're really are trying to do an assessment. One of the dangers of so many institutions is they actually set the agenda, what they want to do in research and what they want their students to do, and then they actually go into these communities and say, "This is what we want to do. You know, help us to do it." I have a different approach, and I think this is based on our faith-based approach, is that our job is actually to go into communities and to say, what are the needs in this community, and what are the assets in this community? Who's already doing things, and then how can we as a academic institution, we're not a social service agency, we are a university, an academic institution, but we're training people to actually do business, and we're training to intervene in social issues. We're training them to actually be involved in the political system and so forth. And so it's our responsibility to do an assessment of the region and see how we can actually take our assets that we actually have and partner with those in the community to actually provide greater education for our students and service to our community.
Fresno is in your university's name, but you are a institution that has branches throughout this region.
Yes.
How significant is that regional footprint to your organization's future?
Well, I think as we've been redefining ourselves, we've kind of gone to, Bakersfield and Merced and Visalia. We see the Valley, Fresno, in some ways, being new here, it's almost kind of the center because it's one of the major cities. So it really becomes a central hub in some ways. But Bakersfield and Visalia, Merced, all of those are actually so important to the Valley, the health of the Valley. And just as we're trying to partner in Fresno, one of our locations, you know, we need to actually have those partnerships actually in these other locations as well. We think part of our strength is in serving a broad audience because we don't expect all of our students to actually graduate and stay in Fresno. But we want to hope that, you know, because we have students in the Valley, you know, say in all these areas. And so we want them to equally feel that they can serve those areas.
You also have a very interesting background. I mentioned it in the introduction. You're an ordained minister, mm-hmm. and you have a PhD in criminology.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. With so much discussion right now about race and issues of criminal justice reform and things, how do you feel your background prepares you for this job in this community at this time?
Well, my bachelor's and master's are also in psychology, you know, so I made the transition to justice because I started working. I have a whole career before becoming an academic, working in justice systems, the whole issue of restorative justice in terms of how do we actually do some things to actually change systems so that they will actually benefit the community, how they actually will impact lives of individuals. And so my whole justice background has all been about change and community change and policy change. In fact, my cognate in my PhD program was planned change. So it's confluent with all that I've been doing in terms of how do you actually have impact, how do you actually make change and so forth. If we would pay attention to what's happening in our justice system, most states, you know, say when we count up the cost that states are paying for justice systems in terms of law and crime and so forth, it's usually in the top three areas of our budgets and so forth. And so we're spending a lot of our tax dollars in this particular area, but we're usually thinking in terms of how do we actually house people, how do we get rid of them. These are people who are going to be coming back into society. So we need to start thinking about change. We have a number of initiatives on campus that we're working with here in the community trying to address some of those issues. But if we think about these justice issues, rather than pushing these things out to the side, these are issues that are endemic to who we are in our community. You say when you have poor and poverty, You see, it's a place of growth for crime. You know, it's a place of growth for discouragement, where hope is actually lost. And when do people actually begin to engage in these type of activities and begin to take advantage of each other? When they begin to get desperate in some ways, when they don't have any hope for the future, they don't have any hope for their children and so forth. So it kind of breeds crime in so many ways. And so how do you actually address those? You know, there's a number of things that you have to do. And we have to begin to focus on those issues as we're thinking about growth and development in our cities.
With your university and your faith's tradition of peacemaking, of mm-hmm. conflict resolution, of mediation,
yes.
mm-hmm. How do you think that those disciplines can be of use in our climate today, especially mm-hmm. with all of the tensions that we see on the news every night, whether it's the racial tensions over Charlottesville or the treatment of persons of color mm-hmm. with law enforcement agencies and the Black Lives Matter movement? Mm-hmm. How can those principles that your university and your faith practice be employed in some way in this larger tension that we have right now in our country?
Well, I think we all go through the rhetoric of talking about how these things can be practiced, but we see very few models of that. And so as you look at these principles that you were talking about in terms of reconciliation and peacemaking, we actually need to be able to demonstrate some models of that in various places. Because people don't want to listen to each other because they don't feel like they've been listened to, you know. And so, and we tend to our leaders over the years have been more and more divisive. We look at our political system in terms of that's the nature of how do we actually accuse each other? How do we actually look at faults? We don't think about what gifts and what assets what people can actually bring to the table. And so when we start talking about reconciliation, peacemaking, you say those are actually principles in terms of how do we actually affirm who people are and what they actually can bring to the table? How do we actually listen to where people are and understand them before we actually start accusing them? You know, say, how do we actually model those type of things, you know, corporately and individually? Some of these things have to be modeled within families, and this is some of the things that we're trying to train our students in. And but how do we actually create those kind of models in our schools? How do we create those models in our government? We need to bring people who are trained in those areas in those situations. We need to be able to do those things in business because this whole idea in terms of that my rights and my needs are the most important things, and I don't really want to hear what you have to say. But if we actually will decide, you know, what is actually best for not just our own selves, but what is actually best for our community and for the broader constituents and people that we actually represent and so forth. And I think peacemaking, reconciliation, the whole ethos of what our university is about has something to bring to the table. And those things, we're hoping that as we're building these partnerships that we can actually bring those messages and that as we give opportunities for our students to be involved and to graduate, we're going to be more intentional about those things.
Mm-hmm. Before we go, just with the recent announcement by the Trump administration of the ending of the DACA program, mm-hmm. Again, being in a diverse community, there are a number of DACA students, as I understand, who are students at your university.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. How is the university approaching this, and what's your statement regarding the recent actions by the Trump administration there?
We have been doing this for over 15 years before we even came up with the term DACA. This has been part of our ethos, part of who we are as an institution. We have always done this before anyone else actually began to talk about it. You know, say, and our motivation for doing this is not because of politicians, not because we've heard people cry out. It's because of who we are as a Christian university. We will continue to do what we have always done. We will be committed to these students, to educate those students. That is part of our ethos. That's part of our mission. That's part of who we are. That's what we call a Christian prophetic university. And being prophetic means that we actually reach out in justice and reconciliation.
We've been talking with Dr. Joseph Jones. He is the new president of Fresno Pacific University. The private nonprofit Christian university has been a fixture in Southeast Fresno for over 60 years and also has campuses in a number of Valley cities. Dr. Jones, thank you so much for being with us today.
It was a real pleasure. We look forward to talking with you all further in the future as you see a number of things that we will be doing in Visalia and Bakersfield and Merced and all of the locations, especially here in Fresno.
Dr. Jones, thank you.
Okay.
And stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment. In the next half of our program, we'll learn how Yosemite is trying to deal with its trash problem. And we'll talk to Fresno Police Chief Jerry Dyer about a new effort to deal with mental health issues and law enforcement. That's coming up straight ahead. This is Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Police officers across the country and in the Central Valley have been under increasing scrutiny and pressure for how they deal with civilians in the field. At the same time, some departments are acknowledging that their role is morphing into one just as concerned with identifying and helping people who might be suffering from a mental illness as it is enforcing the law. Fresno Police Chief Jerry Dyer says he's making changes within his force in an attempt to separate committed criminals from those who need a softer form of help. Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess spoke with Dyer about what he's learned over the last couple of years and changes he hopes to make at the Fresno Police Department.
This is something you and I have talked quite a bit about, which is the interaction between police officers and the force and people who are in some type of mental health crisis. You're kind of taking a new approach here. Walk me through what's going to change between how the police department acted before and how officers are going to behave now.
Sure. Well, there's two things that are happening simultaneously. Number one is we've made the commitment to provide crisis intervention training, which is 40 hours, to every single uniformed officer in the Fresno Police Department. To date, we have just over 200 police officers that have been provided that crisis intervention training. That training not only focuses on identifying what type of mental health issues an individual may be suffering from, but also de-escalation skills, making sure that we're doing everything in our power as officers to not escalate a situation to where force may have to be used, but to do everything in our power to de-escalate that situation and then be able to get that individual into some type of mental health services. The second part of it is utilizing a group of four officers and one sergeant to partner with Behavioral Health of Fresno County and placing our police officers and a mental health clinician in a car together and responding to the calls that are out there that involve somebody in crisis. And the other part of it is also proactively identifying those individuals who are the consumers of a lot of our emergency services, whether that is the police department, American Ambulance, the jail, the hospitals, whatever it is, and making sure that they are getting the focused attention that they need that prevents those repeat calls for service.
When it comes to the four officers and the sergeant, what's different about them that's going to be different from the training that all the other officers are getting?
Well, those particular officers will have the 40 hours of training plus additional training provided to them. They are not going to be wearing a police uniform. They're going to be wearing a different attire. We oftentimes see that sometimes the uniform can serve to escalate a situation or create fear in the part of that individual we're dealing with who has mental health issues. And so the goal is to insert those individuals, those officers, with that training, with the time on their hands to be able to effectively deal with that call. Unfortunately, our police officers have a lot of police calls that they respond to on a daily basis. And although we encourage them to take as much time as they need to handle these calls, the reality is they understand also the need to get back into service at some point in time so that they can handle the next call that is holding. These officers that are assigned to the crisis intervention team will have all the time that they need to, along with the mental health clinician, to effectively deal with those individuals and to make sure that they're identifying what those needs are and getting them in touch with the right services. The average officer on the street is well-trained and understands some of the issues that they're dealing with in terms of mental health and what services are available, but the crisis intervention team will have a greater expertise in that area.
You mentioned before that the department responds to something like 26,000 behavioral or mental health related calls a year. Four officers obviously can't handle 24,000. So is that just a drop in the bucket?
Well, unfortunately, the answer is yes. In a 12-month period, our officers handled about just under 27,000 calls where there was a person in crisis. Now, sometimes that person in crisis does have mental health. Sometimes they have some other emotional issues or alcohol and drug involved. But sometimes it's hard to distinguish who is really suffering from mental health versus somebody that's just emotionally charged or someone that's under the influence of drugs and or alcohol. But we do know that having these officers proactively on the front end focus on those individuals that are the most frequent consumers of those types of calls, that we're going to reduce repeat calls for service. The second thing is, yes, we're not going to be able to respond to all the ones that we'd like to, but this is really more of a pilot project and a beginning point. We're going to see how effective it is, which I know it to be effective, and then expand beyond that. And so one sergeant, four officers to begin with, four mental health clinicians, we anticipate this program growing.
When you say alternative attire to a uniform, are we talking about street clothes? Because a lot of times a uniform can be a signifier to the public that this is someone who can be trusted, whereas someone who's in street clothes claiming they're with the police department might necessarily be trusted.
Yeah, so the police officers assigned to the crisis intervention team will be wearing maybe a polo shirt that identifies them as a police officer with some type of pants that are not police related. But they're really going to be that second responder. They won't be the first responder. They'll still be a police officer, respond to the scene, and then there'll be a request made for the crisis intervention team. That crisis intervention team can respond, establish a rapport, and take the time that they need to be able to resolve that situation. And that's the purpose of them dressing in what sometimes may be seen as an oppressive attire.
You've sort of alluded to this, but there's a difficulty when a call comes in of knowing whether or not it's a person who's in crisis or someone who it's a criminal call. How are you going to sort that out? Is it a matter of identifying, okay, well, this address has had repeated calls, we need to send the crisis team to that instead of a actual officer? How do you sort out when the call comes in what group to send?
Well, we generally know who the individuals are, not just the address, but who the individuals are that are frequent consumers of emergency services. Those are the people that oftentimes are committed for under the Welfare and Institution Code. They're a danger to themselves or others. They're the people that we end up having transported by American Ambulance to the hospital or to Exodus. They're oftentimes are the ones that are being booked into Fresno County Jail because they have been involved in criminal activity. But the goal is to identify those people who are suffering from mental health that might find themselves into the criminal justice system. We know that there are certain people out there that just have an intent to commit a crime. They're going to do it for whatever motivation. There's other people out there that we recognize that commit crimes as a result of them suffering from some type of mental health disorder. Those are the people we want to focus on.
There would be some who would argue that the best intervention might be getting them into an institutionalized setting, whether it's a mental health institution or even an imprisonment setting. What would you say to people who think about that and say, well, why wouldn't you, if they're a danger to themselves or others, why wouldn't you want them in the most secure facility?
Well, they would be, if an individual's a danger to themselves or others, they would be placed in a facility, not necessarily a jail, but Exodus or a facility that can hold them for up to 72 hours while they get their evaluation. And I would argue that it's not so important that we have somebody in a secured facility as much as whether or not they're being diagnosed properly and they're receiving the proper services so that they can be made well. And the last place we want our people introduced to is the criminal justice system, if in fact they're suffering from mental health issues, because it could exacerbate the problem. But if that person has committed a crime and they need to be placed in jail, then certainly that's what we're going to do. And anytime you have somebody that's committed a violent crime, that's going to be the safest place for them.
So what's prompting this? Why the change now?
Well, I think what we have seen is a growing number of calls involving people with suffering from mental health, and it's escalated over the last several years. I don't know if that's as a result of what we went through in the recession. Maybe services were cut back, maybe more people utilizing methamphetamine. Whatever the case is, we know that the numbers are growing and that what we're currently doing is not having the desired effect that we would like, which is why we're partnering now with behavioral health. They're going to be ramping up their services. We're going to be increasing our efforts, and I believe together we'll serve as a force multiplier in terms of how we are able to impact those people on our streets suffering from mental health issues.
Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess last week speaking to Fresno Police Chief Jerry Dyer about the department's new approach to individuals with mental health challenges and the formation of a new mental health crisis team within the department. Stay with us. We'll be back with more of Valley Edition in just a moment, right after this. This is Valley Edition. Yosemite National Park has a trash problem. With more than 5 million people visiting the park last year, the Park Service is working to decrease the amount of trash that ends up in the Mariposa landfill. To find out more about the park's new Zero Landfill Initiative, FM 89's Ezra David Romero spoke with Yosemite National Park Ranger Jody Bailey and wildlife biologist Caitlin Lerini.
Thanks for joining me, Jody and Caitlin.
Oh, glad to be here. Thank you very much for having us.
So I understand Yosemite has a trash problem. What exactly is it? How much trash is being left in the park?
We collect about 2,200 tons of trash in the park every year, and we'd really like to reduce the amount of that because we want to be better green stewards of Yosemite. We also have some real concerns about making sure that we collect the trash as effectively as possible. We don't want it to spill over. When it spills over, it can cause wildlife problems. So one of the great things about this program, about the Zero Landfill Initiative, is that we're really able to not only solve a trash issue, but to address a wildlife problem.
So where does all this trash go at the moment?
Right now, the park sends all of its trash to the Mariposa County landfill. That's where we send our recycling as well.
You were saying the park is trying to reduce this waste problem by like 80%. How's this being done?
What we started with was pretty simple. We started with just trying to make it easier for people to recycle the things that they bring that are recyclable. So in the first year of the Zero Landfill Initiative, which was last year, we bought about 150 new trash and recycling containers. We also put new labeling on the recycling. We've tried to make it really easy for visitors. We collect mixed recycling in the park. That means everything that we collect can go into one container. So the new labels show that clearly with pictures, which makes it really easy for people to understand. We tried to make it a lot more convenient.
So how is Subaru involved in all of this? I understand the car making company has a role.
So Subaru and the National Parks Conservation Association are working with us and the Yosemite Conservancy, as well as our concessioner on this project. And it's really been a fabulous partnership. They've allowed us to do some things that we'd never been able to do before. Most of the trash and recycling containers in the park were 30 to 40 years old. And with the grant funding from Subaru and their expertise in waste management, we've been able to make some really significant changes.
So recycling's not necessarily new for Yosemite. You've been doing it since the 70s, and you weren't recycling as much. Can you talk to me about the history of recycling there?
So as far as I understand it, Yosemite was one of the first parks to have a significant recycling program that came in about the mid-70s. And believe it or not, the design for those containers is something that we've been using, still dates to about that era. Those trash and recycling containers were 30 and 40 years old. And they were designed to be as wildlife-proof as possible at the time. So the new ones that we got are much easier for staff to use, much easier for visitors, and they're much more wildlife-proof.
Yeah, so talk to me about how this initiative will take that original mission for recycling further.
I think what it's going to allow us to do is to just make it a lot easier for people. We had a lot of high visitation sites in the park that just didn't have any recycling containers. I think what happened is over the years they broke or they needed to be moved around, and so some of our busiest spots had trash collection only, Now, with this initiative, we've made sure that every single location has paired trash and recycling. Now, granted, we still have a little bit of the park to go, but we're getting there. We should be finished with the upgrade to all of our infrastructure within the next year.
Let's talk about the trash cans themselves. What do they look like?
The trash are brown. They look a little bit like the kind of blue mailbox that you might typically see on a street in the United States. The recycling containers are of dark green, and they're labeled mixed recycling. And then on the front of them, they have the big chasing arrow symbol to make it easier for people to spot them.
I read on the website that a lot of the trash in the park are water bottles. Is part of this initiative going to focus on a way to reduce the use of plastic?
One of the things that we hope to do in the next year is to start identifying locations for new refill stations, hydration stations, where people can fill their own water bottles, or if they buy a bottle, they can fill it. We certainly are going to continue to sell all kinds of bottled beverages in the stores, but they're in pretty limited places within the park. So if we can expand our refill infrastructure, we're just going to make it a lot easier for people to get the water they need to, you know, have a comfortable and safe experience.
How many of those are there at the moment?
We have them in all of our campgrounds, and then we also have them in a handful of locations here in the valley, probably just two or three at this point.
I've done a lot of reporting in Yosemite around bears, and early on I was surprised that the park fed bears for visitor entertainment. Caitlin, I know this doesn't happen anymore, but how do you think this initiative is going to benefit wildlife in Yosemite?
So the park has a long history of conflicts between bears and people, and much of that revolves around the park's trash. You know, 20, 30 years ago when we got the first bear-resistant trash cans, that really helped solve a lot of our issues, prevented bears from getting human food from most of the park. But over time, you know, we have more visitation, and the trash cans tend to need maintenance over time. So a lot of that trash was still making its way into the mouths of bears, either by overflow or there not being the capacity that was necessary. So this teaming up with Zero Landfills really helped to reduce the amount of trash in the park by increasing recycling, also by making people more aware of where to go to dispose of their trash. And that's made a huge impact on the availability of trash to bears. We have bears that historically have gone to picnic areas looking for trash at night. And since we installed these new trash cans, that behavior has decreased by quite a bit.
So if I'm visiting Yosemite, what kind of advice would you like to give me when it comes to trash?
Well, there are a few things that visitors can do that will make a difference for us. One, if you have a chance to prepare before you come, it'd be great if you could, you know, break things down, get rid of excess packaging at home, try to put it in reusable containers. So if you're going to get a cup of coffee in the park, it'd be great if you'd use a travel mug. If you've got a water bottle, bring it and refill it in the park. Or, you know, you can buy one locally. You could make it your favorite souvenir from the park. Another one for folks who are camping is if you can make that choice, use a stove that runs on a refillable fuel source. Use lanterns that operate on rechargeable batteries. And then, you know, first and foremost, really, the most important thing that folks can do is try to recycle everything that they bring that's recyclable and make sure that all of their trash goes inside a trash container.
At the moment, you have these two options for recycling and regular waste. Is there any thought for compost?
So one of our other great partners in this is our concessioner, Yosemite Hospitality. They do collect back-of-the-house organic material, and we're trying to work with the county to get that composted. And then in a couple of locations, they actually do collect compostable items from visitors. The pizza deck, for example, at Half Dome Village and a couple of other spots like that. You know, maybe we'll be able to test that in a campground at some point in the future. We're still working on, you know, getting that process sorted out with the county. So that may be a while out, but it is a goal. That is 30% roughly of our waste that comes from the park.
And so all of this is going to the Mariposa landfill. Is there enough room there for all this trash with the increased visitors?
The county landfill is already facing a pretty big challenge. It's probably got a lifespan of about 7 or 8 years left. And it's very expensive to close down a facility like that. And it's really expensive to try to find a new one. So by us improving our ability to manage our trash and get more recycling out of here, then that reduces the burden on our local landfill.
Earlier you said the situation was more complicated than you originally thought. What was more complicated about it, and how are you resolving those complications?
So what we didn't recognize when we started was how important the capacity at the county would turn out to be. And I don't mean just capacity to hold the trash. I mean their capacity to process the recycling and the organic waste that we collect from the park.
I understand there's a timeline, right, where you want to decrease this by, say, 80% or so. What's that timeline, and are you going to make it?
We won't hit our goals by the end of 2017, that's for sure. The problem turned out to be a little bit more complicated than we knew when we first started. I think we've definitely made some gains, and we're looking to continue that. But I really think this is going to be a lot like, say, the education that's necessary around how to behave with wildlife. It's going to be an ongoing issue with making sure people understand how to recycle and what to do with their waste products in the park. You know, one of the challenges for us is that people come not only from all over the United States, but from all over the world, and everybody has a different practice for recycling. So when they get here, sometimes they're just not quite sure what to do.
I've been speaking with Yosemite National Park Ranger Jody Bailey and wildlife biologist Caitlin Lironi about the park's goal of diverting 80% of the park's waste from landfills by the end of the year. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks. Thank you.
And that's all for today's Valley Edition. As always, we'd like to know what you think. You can send us an email. We are talk@kvpr.org. And you can also tweet us at KVPR and at Valley Edition. While you're on our website, you can find our Valley Edition podcast. Subscribe there and get this program delivered to your mobile device each and every week automatically. And you can also find our Outdoorsy podcast as well. That's all online at kvpr.org, as well as audio archives of our local reporting, NPR shows, and more. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporters Jeffrey Hess and Carrie Klein, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This has been Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation. With a new partnership, you can now find C-section and other maternity care ratings for your local hospital on Yelp.